Now, let's talk about the second reason that people that you want to keep end up leaving your church. And it's a three-letter word, sin. Sin. S-I-N. The truth is, sometimes people that you want to keep, that you really want to disciple, they leave your church because of sin. Let's think about the example that Jesus gave us in the parable of the sower. You remember this? Jesus told about this wise farmer who went out to sow some seed. And as he scattered his seed, he had a particular field in mind. But truthfully, in that field, some fell on good soil and some fell on bad soil. Now, for the purposes of this resource, I won't necessarily go into all the soils and what Jesus said it meant and how he unpacked it. But if you look at that quite literally, 1/4 of the seed fell on good soil and 3/4 of the seed fell on bad soil. And so I don't know if that's a model to say that for every 4 people you reach, one will stay and grow and bring a harvest of 30, 60, 90, or 100-fold, but maybe so. But the truth is, some of the people that you're going to reach, the seed is going to grow in shallow soil. And so it's going to spring up, but the cares of the world, the heat of the sun, is going to get those people, and they are not going to stay. Now, you can do something about this, and we'll talk about what you can do about this. But you know, the birds are going to get some, the sun is going to get some, the cares of the world are going to get some. And so there are going to be people who come to your church, stay for a little while, but then fall back into that old life of sin. I think the most vivid example for me is a young lady that we baptized at our second journey baptism. At our second journey baptism back in 2003, we baptized a young lady. We'll just call her Nicole. And we baptized Nicole, and Nicole had gone through some major life change in our church and some major life change in her own life. And she had really changed things for the better. She was involved in a group. She was growing. She had a lady in our church who was discipling her. She was on what you and I would call the straight and narrow path. And so she continues to attend for several months after this baptism. She goes through a series of groups, and I start thinking about her about 8 months later, and I realized I hadn't seen her in a while. And I started asking a few people, have you seen Nicole? And they said, well, she stopped coming to our group. I started asking some other people if they'd seen her in worship. They said, well, I think I saw her once a couple of weeks ago. I'm not sure, or whatever it might be. Well, now 10 months into this, maybe even a year into it, I've not seen Nicole in quite a while. And so I'm actually out walking through the city one day, just running some errands. And it's a big city. As you know, New York City is quite a large city. But I'm walking through the city, and I see a person who is a friend of Nicole's, somebody that I'd met before. And she walks up and says hello to me, and I greet her. And in the midst of the conversation, I said, how's Nicole doing? I haven't seen her in a while. And I could tell I embarrassed her friend just a bit. And she kind of put her head down, and she said, oh, you didn't hear? And I said, hear about what? Is she okay? And the lady told me that Nicole had moved back in with her ex-boyfriend, and they were now living together. Now, Nicole never wrote me a letter. She never sent me an email to say, dear Pastor Nelson, God really did something in my life, but I had this opportunity to move back in with my boyfriend, and so I'm going to fall back into sin and fall away from the church, and you're not going to see me anymore. Never did she do anything like that. But she had done what in the old days we used to call backslide. She had backslidden. She was fallen back into sin. They say, well, you know, maybe that says something about the discipleship processes at the journey. Maybe if she had had a better mentor, maybe if she had had a better experience at the group, or maybe this or maybe that. And certainly, I evaluated many of those things in thinking about Nicole, like what could we have done differently? What could we change, and how could we tighten this up, and how could we stay in better touch with her? And you'll hear about some of the changes that we made in our church to try to deal with situations like this. But the truth is, people are going to fall back into sin. The birds are going to get some, the sun is going to scorch some, and the cares of the world are going to strangle some. It is just going to happen. Now, what tricks you when it comes to sin is that if you happen to run into people like Nicole, they usually will not admit that it is sin that's keeping them away from your church. For example, let's say the story had played out differently. Let's say that I was walking through town and I happened to run into Nicole herself. And here's Nicole, who's living in sin. who had experienced just months before major life change, been baptized in our church, had been in a small group, had been matched with a young lady to be her mentor. And maybe I run into Nicole and she perhaps tries to avoid me, but I'm pretty hard to evade. And I finally shake hands with her and give her a hug. And I say, hey, I haven't seen you around the church for a while. It is very likely that Nicole would not admit that she moved back in with her boyfriend. That would be very difficult for her to express to me. Instead, she might make up some reason. She might just say, well, you know, the journey was my very first church experience, and I thought it might be better if I visited a few other churches before I committed. Now, by the way, I'm not just making up that excuse. I've actually heard that excuse. Someone comes to our church for the first time. They were formerly unchurched. They fall into some kind of sin. We catch up with them, and they make the excuse that, well, I really want to visit around some other churches for a while. Or perhaps Nicole would say, you know what? I'm a single mom, and I've got a teenage daughter, and you guys don't have a youth program yet at your church. And so I decided that I needed to get my daughter to a place where they had a youth program. And oh, by the way, Pastor Nelson, I'm sleeping with my boyfriend again. No, she's not going to tell you that. It's just not going to happen. You see, a lot of times when people fall away into sin, they make up a reason that's palatable to give you for why they're leaving because they're embarrassed to tell you the truth. Now, this might be a good time for me to introduce you to one of my old philosopher friends named Blaise Pascal. Now, some of you know I was a computer programmer for many years before going into ministry, and there actually is a computer programming language named after Blaise Pascal, Pascal, P-A-S-C-A-L. Pascal was a Christian philosopher back in the 16th, 17th hundreds, and he was a mathematician who also wrote about philosophy, also wrote about things of faith. And many of you who may have taken an introduction to philosophy perhaps have heard of Pascal's wager. Pascal had an evangelism method that I do not recommend, where he would invite you to wager based on the fact that there might be a God or there might not be a God. And he actually laid it out. He would tell people that there are really only four options in life. There is a God and there is an eternity. There's not a God and there's an eternity. There's not an eternity and there is a God and there's not an eternity, nor is there a God. And he would lay this out as a wager, and he would say, based on that, based on there only being four options in life, I can tell you it's better to believe in God than not. Now, did I just convince you that there's a God based on that wager? Well, Pascal, he thought that was very helpful. But I never found Pascal's wager to be very helpful, and I've certainly not found it to be a tool in helping people come to faith in Christ. But nonetheless, some of you may have studied Blaise Pascal because of Pascal's wager. But there is another piece of the puzzle that Pascal discovered that I think is very, very correct and very, very insightful and still stands the test to today. And that is what has been known as Pascal's congruence principle. And Pascal posited that people have to live with congruence between their beliefs and their behavior. In other words, it's very difficult for me to go too long living in a way where my beliefs do not match my behavior. And so, if I am behaving in a godly way, I will soon adapt my beliefs in a godly way. If I'm behaving in an ungodly way, I will soon adopt and adjust my beliefs to an ungodly way. And honestly, this congruence principle has helped me understand why people leave church when they fall into sin. So let's go back to example of this young lady I'm calling Nicole. Nicole left our church to move back in with her boyfriend. Now, for the previous 6 or 7 months, she had been growing in her beliefs. She was a new Christian. She was a relatively young Christian, so to speak, and she had a lot to learn, but she was on the right path with her beliefs. And she was adjusting her behaviors accordingly. But you know, Nicole had 27 or 37 years of sinful experience under her belt. And so it was easy, unfortunately, for her to fall back into that old lifestyle. Perhaps she had an encounter with an old boyfriend. Who knows what happened? But somewhere along the way, she decided that it was okay for her to behave in such an incongruent way as to move back in with her boyfriend. And even though her beliefs were moving in one direction, she put herself in the position where her behavior went in another direction. And so she could not live with that incongruence too long. Now, for a while, she could do it. In fact, the first Sunday after she moved in with her boyfriend, she may have come to church. But that tension was too great, so she skipped a few weeks. And then maybe she got up the courage to come back a month later. But again, the church simply reminded her of the incongruence in her life. And unfortunately, it was easier for her to change her beliefs than it was for her to change her behavior. And so she fell away from the church. She left the church. Now, were our beliefs wrong at the church? Of course not. Was our discipleship process wrong at the church? Probably not. Was Pascal correct about people needing to live with congruence between their behaviors and their beliefs? Absolutely. He was absolutely correct. And you see, whenever someone is pulled back into that old way of sin, unless they have very strong beliefs in their life or belief systems in their life or people around them to help them, they will very quickly adjust their beliefs to match their new sinful behavior to which they are returning. So you say, how do you solve this problem? I've been very descriptive. How do you prescribe a solution to this problem? Well, this is probably the most difficult of all the reasons that we're going to look at in this resource. It's the most difficult one to address. It's the most difficult one to prescribe. But let me give you some thoughts on how to get people who have fallen into sin to stay at your church, to stick back with your church. First thing, examine the culture of your church to make sure it's a culture of grace. It's a culture of grace. You see, the only way you can reach someone who has fallen back into sin is to teach them about grace. You see, it really is true. When sin abounds, grace abounds even more. Instead of condemning Nicole, our church's responsibility was to extend grace to her. But the truth is, I have to create a culture of grace way before a young lady like Nicole comes to our church. And so you have to preach on grace. You have to teach on grace. You have to go above and beyond to talk about extraordinary, extravagant, over-the-top grace in your church. Because it's only when you have that kind of culture can the person who comes to church but falls back into sin will ever be reclaimed again. And this starts with you. It starts with you as the leader of your church. You have to have an attitude. Instead of asking people, where have you been? You extend to them a gracious welcome home. And I think the great example of this in Scripture is the prodigal son. You know, when the prodigal son returned home, the father did not condemn the son. Instead, the father threw a party for the son. And so we have to do that in our church. We have to create an atmosphere, a culture where people who have been away from church for a while can come back without condemnation. Now, number two, a second way that you can handle this prickly issue of people falling into sin is that you can keep the door open after they leave. Now, this is an element of grace, of course. Grace keeps the door open. Grace leaves the light on for the prodigal son. Grace stands at the door expecting the return of the sinner every week. But grace also makes sure that the door is not slammed when they leave. It reminds me of that old saying about don't let the door hit you or the good Lord split you when you're walking out the door. Well, as people walk out the door of your church, you don't want to slam that door behind them. And that leads me to a controversial discussion about exit interviews. You know, many times when you hear someone talk about the topic that we're exploring in this resource, they will talk to you about exit interviews. Well, in my opinion, exit interviews are an absolute waste of time. You say, well, Nelson, tell us what you really mean. Well, what I really mean is that exit views are an absolute waste of time. Because if I had conducted an exit interview with Nicole, she would never have admitted to me that she was living with her boyfriend, or at least the chances of that happening without a really bright light and some kind of interrogating room, are pretty slim. But instead, she would have come up with something that was palatable. She would have given me reasons for why she left that she thought I could accept. Well, you know, the people at the church, they're just a good bit older than me. Well, you know, I'm really not into that type of music. Well, you know, you really didn't have the kind of student ministry that I wanted. She would have come up with reasons that were palatable to me in order to get out of that exit interview situation, but she would have never told me the real reason. And then I would have made adjustments in our church based on false data. And it's my proposition, without going into a two-hour discussion on exit interviews, that the reasons that you get in an exit interview, the suggestions you receive in an exit interview, are actually based on false data. And you say, well, what if we did the exit interviews anonymously, or what if we did that? Well, think about it from a sin standpoint. Sin always wants to hide. And if you've been in ministry long enough to realize that people do not always tell you the truth, then perhaps you understand what I'm talking about when I say avoid exit interviews. Because exit interviews will lead the person who's being interviewed to a place where they are forced to be deceptive. It will lead you to make decisions based on information received through deception. And I think this is the biggest reason of all, and exit interviews, think about the name, exit interviews close the door on someone from ever returning to your church. You see, if I hold an interview, an exit interview with someone who leaves, think about how terribly difficult it is for that person to ever return. You know, I don't know if studies have been done on this in the corporate world or not, but my suspicion is even in the corporate world where they talk about exit interviews, that the likelihood of a person who's gone through an exit interview ever reapplying for a job with that company would be pretty slim. And I can tell you, based on experience of having coached hundreds of pastors and having extensive experience in ministry, that when you conduct an exit interview with someone who has left your church, their chances of ever returning to your church are slim to none, because you've simply closed the door. And now it would be an embarrassment for them to return. Now it would be a major hurdle over which they have to climb to return. Now they would have to not only come back and repent of their sin that took them away from the church, but they would have to say to you that all that stuff we told you in our exit interview was a lie. And so I strongly suggest you do not conduct exit interviews, but instead you leave the door open for them to return. Now, let me tell you the rest of the story about Nicole. Nicole eventually did return to our church, and I never told her that I had the conversation with her friend that day on the street. I never told her that I found out that she was living with her boyfriend. Now, I did find out that she confessed this to one of her small groups, that she asked prayer of her small group leader. And once in a sermon on forgiveness, she did write on her connection card a prayer of forgiveness about her past sin. But I believe that by leaving the door open, not conducting an exit interview with her, created an atmosphere of grace, we allowed someone to fall into sin and then be restored in our church. Now, there is one other thing that you can do with people who are leaving your church because of sin. And that is, you can keep them on your database. Keep them in your database. Now, as Nicole left, and I know I'm just using her as an example, but there's plenty of other examples that I could give you. But even though Nicole left our church, I continue to send her invites to our big days at the Journey. I continue to keep her on our email list, and we have a weekly email newsletter that goes out. I continue to send out the general invites to her and to keep her updated on all that was going on in our church. We kept her on the list. And from time to time, when we would pull the list of people in our church that we hadn't seen in a while, we would pray for her because she was on that list. I honestly can't think of any reason why you would ever delete a name from your database. You see, I could have gone back to the office that day after I had that conversation with Nicole's friend And I could have said, pull Nicole's record. The birds have got her. The sun has scorched her. She's been choked up by the cares and tears of the world. Let's remove her from our database. She is now a sinner. And I could have put a big scarlet A on her database record and taken her out of our system. Now, by the way, I believe in a pure membership, but I do not necessarily subscribe to a pure database. I mean, if we had to take out all the sinners from our database, nobody would be left on that database, including me. So I kept her on the database because I thought, you know, maybe she'll check email this week and decide to return. Or maybe she'll get that mailer next week and decide to return. I kept her on the list because I always held out hope, like that father, desiring to see the prodigal son return, that today might be the day that she returns. And so it is with people in your church. Someone may fall back into alcoholism. Continue to keep them on your list. Continue to preach grace and let it be known that if there is a place where a former alcoholic can come to church, it's your church. Someone falls back into drugs, let it be known. If someone falls back into sexual sin, let it be known that your church is a church of grace. You do not endorse the behavior. You do not encourage the behavior, but you embrace the person who returns to the gospel. And you will do everything you can to help them get up out of that pit they've fallen into, that you will kill the fatted calf, you will bring out the ring for the finger, and you will restore them to godliness if they're willing to return to God. You see, the only solution to sin is grace. Preach grace. Leave the door open so that grace can flow out. And then keep them on your database so that they know grace is still being offered.